Hi, and welcome to the Movie Exchange Club. This is a new idea that we've got together and put together over the last few months. My name is Sam Inglis. I write for 24 Frames Per Second, Multimedia Mouth. And joining me today in the Movie Exchange Club, we've got Super Marcy of supermarcy.com and Killer Film.
Hi.
We've also got Big Germain, also of supermarcy.com and co-presenter of the excellent Super Podcast.
Damn straight.
And Michael Ewens, writer at eFilm Blog, Multimedia Mouth, and contributor with me to the Screening Room Podcast.
Hello, good to be here.
So hopefully it's a bit of an all-star cast, and over the last couple of months we've been assigning each other movies. Each of us has assigned each of the others a film that they have never seen before to watch. And so we've got a whole bunch of movies that we're going to discuss and get reactions to over the next however long we happen to be sitting here. Marcy, I don't know quite how you want to start this, but why don't you pick somebody to talk about what they've been assigned.
All right, I'll pick on Mike and he can discuss one of the films.
Thank you ever so much, Marcy. Okay, I think we'll start with what Bede recommended me then, which is White Dog, a 1982 film by Samuel Fuller, which I believe was banned for a very long time until something like last year when it was released on Criterion. I'll just double check that while I'm talking about it. And, Bede, do you just want to give me a little bit of background on, like, why you recommended this to me? Because we don't really know each other very well, and it's quite an interesting film.
It is. I sort of recommended you this film, just based on the films that you like, of course, whenever you review films on, put your little mini reviews up on Twitter, based on what you like and don't like, I sort of thought, maybe White Dog might be a good choice for you to watch, because it seems like a film that might be just right up your alley in terms of the films that you find interesting or that you like.
Cool. Okay. So I've just looked at this background information and see that it was banned basically because companies thought it was promoting a racist message, which obviously it's not. It's completely ridiculous. But it was released on Criterion last year. And I think okay, so here's my thing with White Dog. It's an interesting film, but I thought it was rarely a good one, to be honest. And I think that's largely down to the fact that it's one of the most indecisive films I've ever seen. It doesn't quite know whether it wants to be like a borderline exploitation horror, a political drama, or a romance between the woman and the dog, which it is at all different points in the film. And it's like, sorry, what?
I'd say anything.
Okay. I thought someone said something. Sorry. It's just my microphone is obviously playing tricks on me. But basically, yeah, I thought like, and all of that stuff is interesting, but I felt like I wanted a film to each one of those individual things, not all wrapped up in this 80-minute package, which is a bit over here, a bit over there, a bit uneven. And I read on IMDb on the trivia that when the film came out, the producers put out a tag that said, we want the film basically to be like Jaws with paws. And that, in a way, is kind of the film I wanted it to be. Of course, that goes against it being on the Criterion label, which primarily takes out art films, which is what Samuel Fuller did as well. You look at something like Shock Corridor, which is basically, it is kind of exploitative and everything, but it is the film where someone walks into a room and says nymphos in a quite over-the-top way. White Dog just doesn't know what movie it wants to be. There is a moment around the hour mark, which was just hilarious, where the dog breaks out of its cage where it's being kept. I should probably summarize the plot a little bit here. Sorry for how messy this is. Basically, it's based on a true story which happened to Jean Seberg, who people will know for Goddard's Breathless, a woman hit a dog with her car and took it to the vets and got it better and decided to look after it because she didn't know who it belonged to. And it turned out to be a white dog, which is a dog that's been trained by its owner to be racist, essentially, and attack black people. And she finds this out and she takes it to a trainer who attempts to heal it, cure it, basically, from this hate that has been bred into the dog. So my problem is, around the hour mark, there's a sequence where the film really needs to be winding down and getting to its point, and the dog escapes, and it suddenly becomes like a dog on the loose exploitation action movie, which you'd expect to find in a bargain basement. And people are shouting these tinier dialogue like, "The dog busted out of the compound," and it's like, "No, it didn't. What are you doing? This is not the place the movie needs to be around the hour mark, when it needs to be making its point." And I really wanted it to make a point, but it kind of didn't. I don't know if you got anything from it, like in regards to it being a message movie in terms of it making a political point, or whether you kind of see it as more of the exploitation thing.
I sort of saw it as kind of both. Like, I think it sort of, in my opinion, it sort of was able, in my opinion, to do both sides at some times. It kind of, like the dog attack sequences, I do agree, are kind of the way they shot and the way they edited and all that and the way they handled are very sort of almost horror movie-esque.
Yeah, very much so. It's all like point of view shots and handheld camera and that sort of thing.
And of course, you've got sort of the political sort of subtext of the film as well. But I think the movie does well on both, and I think it sort of is able to gel both those together as a whole. Well, that's how okay. I gathered from the film, but I can understand, like, because it is sort of, like, somebody could watch it and see that it is kind of uneven, because it's not sure whether it wants to be, like, this horror movie, or it wants to be sort of a film dealing with racism. But I think it does both extremely well. Like, the dog attack sequences are very intense, and they are quite horrifying, and also the political subtext of the film is very interesting, and actually makes the film just a very compelling watch. And it also, because I said on a previous podcast, it's definitely one of the most interesting films that I've seen in the past few years that does deal with racism. And it's not and I think it does. I think it does both sides very well. And I think, like I said earlier, I think it gels it quite well together. But like I said when I was talking about it on a previous show, that it's not a perfect film. Like, I do agree with some flaws. It has flaws, but like some total unevenness. But I think overall, I think all those aspects that you sort of mentioned, you sort of had trouble with, I actually did really liked a lot about the film. And in my opinion, it kind of sort of gelled all those aspects quite well together.
Right, okay. Well, I mean, like I say, I do think it's a really interesting film. It's certainly a brave film. It's a film that properly tackles racism, perhaps in a bit of a heavy-handed way. There's that attack sequence where the dog escapes and kills someone in a church, and it looks up to the stained glass portrait of St. Francis of Assisi, where it's all covered in blood, and that portrait is, you know, about the white dog being purity, and that's a bit of a metaphor, and it felt like... And the thing about that sequence is you see the shot of that stained glass window, then it cuts back to the dog and then cuts back to the painting again. And I felt like hammering it home a bit now, but I certainly think it's a brave film for tackling these themes, and it doesn't really shy away, no matter how many tonal twists and turns it makes that I find uneven. It's an interesting film, and it's a film that needs to be seen, and it was bad that people pushed it down and repressed it and said that it was a film promoting racism. It clearly isn't. Yeah. But yeah, I had fun with it, certainly. I mean, it's 80 minutes long. It does have that exploitation film going on. It's paced. It's a movie I would recommend to people just because there's nothing else quite like it, and it makes a point and it's exciting. But I think people expecting narrative coherency, tonal coherency, something which really gives them food for thought and the full-on slasher stuff, it doesn't meld together. But yeah, I mean, I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad you recommended it to me, because it's probably something I would have let me slip by otherwise. So yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah, well, I sort of say, if people expect it to, like you say, be Jaws but with paws, I'd suggest to go out and find Cujo, which probably does that sort of, dog Jaws parody, Jaws stuff much better. But this one's, if you're expecting that with this film, you'll get some of that, but it's complete, but it has a lot more to say than a lot of people would expect it to be. So it, like I said,
absolutely,
it's definitely one, like I said earlier, it's definitely one of the most unique films that deals with racism. And I think just based on that alone, it should be watched. And everyone should go out and watch it. And, Yeah, so, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Did you guys like? Do you guys want to give it like a rating out of 5?
Out of 5, okay. Let me think about this. Now I hadn't planned on this. I think just for the message it promotes, the fact that it's important and it doesn't shy away from that, needs to boost it up from how I regard it tonally and cinematically on a deconstructive level. So I think about a 3 out of 5 would do it. What about you, Bede?
Do I go with halvesies or just, you know,
one through? You can do halvesies.
I actually gave it a 4.5 out of 5. I really liked the movie that much. And I think in some ways it is an important film to watch, and it's Mike said, it's both insightful and also it's very thrilling as well. And I think those aspects still work together, despite the unevenness. But I really like the movie a lot, and I suggest everyone to go check it out. So yeah,
and I haven't seen it, so I can't comment.
But you can also read my. Oh, sorry. I was going to say, like, if you want to read more of my thoughts on the film, you can actually read my mini review on it on the Supermarcy .com's recommendations of the week, which I wrote more about the film and my thoughts on it. So check that out. So yeah,
cool.
I haven't seen it either, but I'm definitely going to make it a priority. It's a film that I've been wanting to see for ages and just kind of not got around to. So that lengthy list.
Yeah, it's that one that goes on just forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
Marcy, do you want me to do my next film, or are we going to go to someone else?
We'll go to somebody else. We'll mix it up, because I was thinking, Bede should talk about what you did, but then it's just you guys talking, so we'll try and change it up a little bit.
Okay.
So maybe Sam wants to have a shot?
Well, I tell you what, how about this? If I do Bede's film as well. And that was an Australian film called Wake in Fright, though the title I saw it under was Outback. And I should say, I was only able to see this on YouTube in an incredibly washed out print, which the comments informed me was at least slightly cut. I believe there was a male rape scene removed towards the end of the film. So with all those caveats, I've got to say I wasn't massively enthusiastic about it. It's a film about a British school teacher who's teaching, I believe, in Sydney. And I think it must be sometime in... probably the 60s or the 70s?
About 70, yeah, early 70s.
Okay. And so obviously, you know, transport links and mobile phones and things like that, much harder to come by. Mobile phones don't exist, but, you know, transport links harder to come by. And during the school holidays, he sort of goes off into the outback. And one day he's gambling, loses all his money, and through that he ends up getting taken up with this group of drunken guys who take him out hunting and sort of in a slightly menacing way bring him into the fold of their group of drunk, rabble-rousing friends. Would you say that's kind of there?
Something like that, yeah. Well, basically, yeah. But I think there's a little more to it, but we can discuss that in a moment.
Cool. What I did like about it is it does create kind of an otherworldly atmosphere. The outback feels like something even from a Sydney that is not as built up as we see it now, obviously. It feels like something that is quite alien and quite different. And you do get this sense, Ted Kotcheff, who's the director, is very good about giving this sense of sort of blasted space, of, you know, distance between things and people. That works very nicely. What I didn't get... And in a movie called Wake in Fright, this is kind of key, is the sense of menace and the sense of, indeed, fright are, I thought, largely absent. And that for me was really because most of the time, even though these guys are quite nasty and quite menacing, one of them, it turns out, played by Donald Pleasance, who's actually very good here. You don't get the sense of, for most of the time, the school teacher is actually enjoying their company, it seems, largely. There are times when he's uncomfortable, but he ends up going along with everything, and not, I didn't get the sense that that was through fear, which I suppose it's probably meant to be. It does, I think, pick up towards the end. There's a quite strikingly edited sequence where he starts remembering the things that have happened over the past couple of days that he's been with these people, and that he's been drunk, largely revolving around a day when they've been very, very drunk together and hunting kangaroos in what I've got to say is a rather upsetting sequence. And though they say no kangaroo was killed expressly for the movie, there are still things that I think are very, very uncomfortable about that sequence from a moral standpoint. But I think you get the dislocation and the menace of it much more after the fact, and that works very nicely. But there's a long period, about 90 minutes, that is quite plodding and not as... It doesn't have that sort of vice-like grip that I think it needs and wants to achieve. But there are definitely interesting things in it. I just don't think that they're kind of developed to a high enough degree for my liking.
Well, I don't really see it as kind of like, I guess, kind of a thriller-esque where he, the character of John, who's played by Gary Bond, is supposed to be completely terrified of these guys. I think it's really a movie about somebody's own self-destruction, because he's basically, throughout the first half of the movie, he feels like he's a smart, well-educated teacher, and then he's supposed to go to Sydney because he really doesn't like teaching in this very small town in the outback. And then he goes...
Oh, I'm sorry, I've got myself turned around. He's not coming from Sydney, he's going to Sydney. I do apologize.
Yeah, and he can't wait to get back to Sydney so he can, you know, get back to civilization. And he sort of stops off in this little town in the movie called Yabanda, I think it's called.
I think is what they refer to it.
Yeah, they just call it the Yabba, which is, and he just stops off there, and sort of through that first half of the movie, he sort of sees basically what local life is like, and how the locals act, and he sort of kind of scoffs at them at certain points, and he kind of figures, oh, I'm better than all these guys, and eventually, like in a game of two up, which is a very popular Australian game, he loses all his money and basically he can't leave and he misses his flight and basically he's stuck in the small town. And then from there, he basically just hangs out with the group of guys. And eventually, as he sort of gets more involved with them and gets involved with all the aspects of their daily lives, like kangaroo hunting, I should say, drinking and partying and all that, he becomes more like them, and eventually he gets to a point where he realizes that he's practically hit the bottom and he's become what he didn't want to be, which is what they are. And I think that's, and he wants to try to leave, to get out of that town as quickly as possible, because he knows that if he stays there, he's basically going to be one of those, like Donald Pleasance's character.
Yeah.
Who used to live in the city, and he came out there to the town and basically is just wasting his life every day in that sort of small town, never leaving when he could leave, but he can't. And he just sort of has that sort of fear of being just like him. And I think that's where the fright aspect of the film is. I don't think it's more it's not really a horror movie. It's really sort of, a tale of one guy's self-destruction. See, I think that's what
this is really interesting to me, because even though I didn't particularly like the film, you're making me think, oh shit, I've misinterpreted it. I need to go back and see this again.
I must say, if you do watch it, try to track down, because they actually went I think 2 years ago, they released it on DVD and Blu-ray, and I actually did watch the DVD in preparation for the show, and the restoration is stunning.
Well, I mean, I think that would help as well, because, like I say, the copy I saw was so washed out that, I mean, there was a particular shot where they're pulling up to the house in daylight in a car, and I think the car's white as well. And it was basically just blasted white, the screen. You couldn't really make anything out. And there were quite a few moments like that. I did also notice, and I don't know if this was a fault with the video or a fault with the film, but during a lot of the Rue hunt, the dubbing on the dialogue is really appalling. And they seem to have dropped out the sound effects in quite a lot of that. So you've got silent footage of kangaroos and the car chasing them, and just quite poorly dubbed in voices. Well, that's how it seemed to me from the copy that I was watching. Again, I'm not sure if that's a fault with the film or with the copy I saw.
I think it might be with the copy I saw, because the sound and everything in that particular sequence was well edited and it is crystal clear. But actually, you said earlier about the thought that the film was cut in some areas, but apparently the scene that was majorly cut in the movie was actually the kangaroo hunt sequence, because that disturbed a lot of people. And the sequence in the version I saw, which is you can go out and buy or rent on DVD and Blu-ray now in Australia, is the uncut version of that scene. And they actually did have a disclaimer after the movie saying that about the producers, which to say that we wanted to show that sequence uncut, and we actually had, with the help of cooperation of sort of the animal protection agencies in Australia, like allowing us to put that
frankly
scene in.
I find that as spurious as the defense of animal killing in something like Cannibal Holocaust, actually. I don't think there's any reason that you need to do that. And whether you just filmed a Rue hunt that was happening anyway, or whether you set it up for the movie, doesn't make a massive amount of difference to me. I think there are definite moral questions to be had about that that sequence.
Mm. Well, at the time, like, this film was made in 71, probably at different filmmaking styles, and a lot of things you could get away with more at that time than, say, what you can get away with something right now. But what I loved about the film is I live in a small country town, and a lot of aspects about this film actually rang true to me. And I was really impressed by the fact that Ted Kotcheff, who's actually a Canadian director, and the film's screenwriter, Evan Jones, who's a British screenwriter, were able to really capture what Australian life is like, especially at that period of time, but also small country town life as well. Like, I'm not going to say the town that I live in is exactly like as it's depicted here, but there are aspects of that small town that, you know, I've seen growing up, and, you know, I've actually participated in kangaroo hunts and all that, and growing up as well, because that's the stuff you just grow up with. And when I watched the film the first time the last year, I just felt so in awe of this film, because it was able to perfectly capture what that Australian life is like. Is it kind of, I can understand, like, some people may be troubled by the description of how, like, you know, what a small town life, an Australian life is like, but I think that kind of serves a purpose. And I like the fact that Kotcheff brought sort of an outsider's look.
I think that stuff actually is probably the stuff that works best. It does have kind of an otherworldly feel to it. As I say, in assessing its aims, I may have kind of misidentified them, and maybe I have to sort of rewatch it. But gosh, now I'm really confused about what to go with as a score.
Yeah, because it's not quite the movie as you expected it to be.
Because I feel like, from talking to you about it, I feel like I've misinterpreted it. So, yeah, giving it the original two that I had thought is probably unfair. but I don't really know how to give it any other score because I would need to see it again, I think. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
So I feel like I've kind of fucked up here.
That's all right.
But it's not an uninteresting film. It's a film that didn't quite work for me this time, I think. But going back to it, having kind of talked it through with you, it might be more interesting. It might work for me in other ways. I do think there are good performances though, and I do think there are interesting things, at play here. So I think that kind of sums it up.
Yeah, well, I think this film for me, I actually was blown away by this film the first time I watched it last year, and I was blown away by it again the second time I watched it. You also brought up something about the film earlier, which is kind of, I won't probably want to say again because I don't want to like go into spoiler territory, but I will say in the version I saw, which is the uncut version, that scene's not in it, but it's more implied than anything.
All right. Well, as I say, maybe that was, again, misidentified in what I read, because... Like I say, obviously, I hadn't seen the film before or I had any real knowledge of it before, so maybe that person just got that wrong.
That's all right, though.
Because there is a moment in that sort of series of cuts that very much sort of confronts it a bit more.
Yeah. Well, I think some of those cuts, I think besides the kangaroo stuff, I do recall somebody... like reading something about some aspects of that stuff was actually cut as well, not to make it too obvious, I suppose. So they cut a couple of frames and all that out so people wouldn't be too disturbed by it. But I think when they refix it, it's definitely much more implied in the movie. You don't actually see it, but you'd get implied about it. So, and it kind of establishes why the character so... in need to get out of that town later on, but I absolutely love the movie. I think it's definitely one of the best Australian films I've ever seen, and I give it 5 stars. I think it's very uncompromising as a film. It's unsettling and it's very powerful. The performance is amazing. Donald Pleasance, definitely one of the best performances he's ever given.
There's that terrific shot of him with the two up tokens on his eyes, which is just really menacing and great.
It is. But I'd definitely suggest, like, if anyone is interested in checking out the film, definitely seek it out. But don't try it, like, watch the YouTube version, I assume. But go find the DVD and Blu-ray. I'm not sure if it's available anywhere else in the world, so you might have to buy it through... an Australian DVD Blu-ray website, but it's definitely worth checking out. And I'm actually thinking about going out to buy the Blu-ray now, just looking at the restoration of just the DVD alone was stunning. So, that's pretty much it about what I have to say about Wake and Fright. So, yep.
Yeah, I think that about covers it. So, I mean, cheers for the recommendation, Beat, and I'll try and give it another look, but obviously not on that print. And I think after this discussion, I'll probably have a very different take on it next time. So cheers.
Yeah, but once you sort of get an idea of like what I interpreted about the film, it kind of puts the movie in a whole different light when you sort of rewatch it again. Especially,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So I guess that's all we have to say about the movie.
Well, I haven't seen it, so I can't add anything in at all.
But you should.
No, same here. I haven't seen it, unfortunately. But that thing you say about it having an otherworldly tone, I think that's something that's very true of a lot of Australian cinema as well. I think of Walkabout, The Proposition, Road Games, a couple of other Australian
films. Hanging Rock, absolutely, as well.
Yeah, it's something that's very true of Australian cinema, so that makes me excited to see this film alone. So.
Yeah, cool.
Cool.
And I'll go next with a movie that Mike picked out for me, which is Love is the Devil, A Study for a Portrait of Francis Bacon. The film was written and directed by John Maybury. I probably pronounced that wrong because I don't know.
No, that's right.
Yeah, okay. I always pronounce things terribly wrong.
As you do.
Yeah, so I don't even know if how I can explain this movie. It's like, it's almost kind of a biography in a way of the British painter Francis Bacon, and it starts off with a man called George Dyer breaking into his house, and when he finds him there, he basically asks him to go to bed with him, and then they start this very bizarre relationship, and the movie just focuses mainly on that, and it's shot very strangely. It's almost like it wants to be a piece of his artwork in the way that it's presented. It's shown in little bits and pieces. It doesn't really flow in any real way. And it just has these little sort of glimpses into this very strange relationship. And, you know, the main cast is Derek Jacobi as Francis Bacon and Daniel Craig as George Dyer. And I don't think I'd really seen Daniel Craig in anything back this early. This was a film from 98. So yeah. That was definitely very interesting. And I have to say it's probably one of his best performances, because he really just is something else. There's, you know, supporting players, but the film really just focuses on those two guys and that relationship. I mean, it's hard for me to even explain, because I don't know how I really felt about this movie. It's very strange. It's just, it's odd.
Yeah, I've seen this film a couple of times. In fact, I've seen it 3 times now. I watched it again in preparation for the podcast. And the first 2 times, I didn't know how I felt about it at all. I literally finished the film and thought, do I love it or do I hate it? Because it's one of the two. And I didn't know either way the second time either. But the third time I watched it this week, actually, I really loved it a lot more. I think it picks up the more and more detail you observe, the more and more you understand the characters. And actually, the first time I saw it, I agreed with you about it having not much narrative coherency, how it kind of just flows in weird ways. But this time I found it had a lot more structure and it felt a lot more complete to me. So it'll be interesting if you choose to watch this film a few more times, which I think you should.
I mean, I could even pick up on, like, you know, if I watch it again, I'm probably going to pick up more and it's going to make a little more sense and things are going to, you know, flow a bit better. But just on that initial viewing, I really don't know what to think about it, but I have the feeling this is something that I will watch again and probably end up loving a lot more. Yeah. I think it has that potential. It is definitely something... It was not meant to just be seen the one time, I don't think.
Absolutely.
And it really feels like a piece of artwork where you have to dissect it in a way as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I recommended it to you was because I know you love David Lynch. That's really the one thing I know you love in terms of cinema. And Francis Bacon has influenced David Lynch. He's said as much. And so I thought, this is an interesting film. It's got that slightly Lynchian element. There's a lot of surrealism in the film, which actually I think owes more to a specific 70s movement than the work of Lynch. That's why I recommended it to you. I mean, do you kind of see any of that in the work?
Yeah, without a doubt. Lynch? Watching it, I was almost like, did David Lynch, like, run out and make this by any chance? Yeah. It almost felt like that. It's not as frustrating as some of his movies can be, but it's just, I think it's more in the way it is really presented. It's so strange. There are some scenes that look like they've been shot inside a glass. Mm-hmm. They're sort of very, very strange, but they're like the specific scenes at every kind of scene and different situation. It feels like it's shot very differently from the next one. And it represents the different things.
Yeah, I think the cinematography is incredible, actually. It is. Really inventive.
And I also didn't really mind seeing Daniel Craig naked in a bathtub.
Going to mention that, because that was the thing I remember you noticing, because we were chatting while you were watching this movie, and shall we say, distracted for a moment.
Yeah, I couldn't really concentrate, because I was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I might rewind that. No. but of course, you know, I was going to notice that. He's a very handsome man. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that scene in itself is actually, you know, not just pretending he's not, you know, showing everything. I mean, that scene in itself is actually really well shot.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful film and also an ugly film, but it suits the film whenever it is one of those two things. I think it's endlessly fascinating. And what I love about it is, even though it's based partly on Francis Bacon's, on an authorized biography of Bacon, it's quite an unsympathetic portrait. It's kind of, he's not shown in a good light. He's shown as a bit of a bastard, which by all accounts I think he was.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't know that for a fact. I like the fact that it doesn't compromise, that it never says, ask you to like this person, and as well as getting over the fact that you're not really being presented with straightforward, likable characters. They're complex and annoying. You also have the surrealism, the really bizarre shots and the structure, and everything about this film is difficult, but it's rewarding, and I just like how brave it is and just how out there it is. And I think you're right about the performances. I think Daniel Craig was very rarely has been better. The one performance that really annoys me about it is Tilda Swinton's, and I really love her, but it's just such a screeching, scenery-chewing, like, chalkboardy performance. I hate it. But, yeah, that's really one of the only bad things about the film for me.
Yeah, I agree. I wasn't really a big fan of her in the movie. I don't know, it was almost unnecessary. But in a way, you sort of need that because it really establishes how their relationship was alone and how it was within the group of people. And, you know, from the way it starts off, you know, he breaks into his house and suddenly, oh, yeah, let's go to bed. It's like, oh, that guy just broke into your house. What is going on?
Yeah.
It's very odd. And it doesn't really hold anything back. It shows this in a, while it is very surreal and strange, it does show it in a very frank way where it's like, well, I'm not going to tell you to like this person, hate this person. This is what it is. And, you know, it is, there's so many different layers. Like, I really look forward to actually watching it again and picking up on a lot of the different stuff that didn't quite click to me the first time.
Yeah, it's a full-throttle work of art, and people are bound to hate it, but I think the fact that that is true is why it's so interesting, and I personally now, after a couple of years of watching it, really love it, and I think it also helps, perhaps, if you know a bit about the actual art of Francis Bacon, if you've seen the pictures and given them time. None of them actually appear in the film because they weren't licensed to be able to be allowed to use those, unfortunately. But, yeah, it does help to get a picture of the man before you even watch the film, if you're aware of that art, which was very, again, kind of uncompromised and weird and dangerous. But, yeah, I think it's a great film.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really happy you recommended it to me. It's, like, from when you mentioned it, I mean, I thought it sounded interesting and something I would definitely would have, you know, if I'd seen it somewhere, I would have sought it out and seen it anyway, so... Yeah, very much a good recommendation. And I think my score's kind of sitting on like 4 out of 5-ish. I'm not sure what I gave it originally, but it's kind of sitting there. I think on a rewatch, it'll probably still hold up.
Yeah, I think I'm about a 4, 4.5 on it now. Mm. It's really an extraordinary piece of work.
It really is something very interesting and different. And yeah, I would recommend checking it out for those who haven't seen it.
Yep.
Cool. Well, I would be among those people. I have seen John Mabry's other couple of films, though, and I just wanted to pick up the point about the cinematography, because I think that's always a strong suit of his work, from what I can see. I've seen images from this film, and it looks stunning, but The Jacket and The Edge of Love, whatever their strengths and weaknesses, and they both have both, are both beautiful, beautiful films to look at.
Absolutely, yeah.
There are moments in The Edge of Love that are, I mean, genuinely painterly. It's a really beautiful film. And, yeah, he's clearly somebody very, very interesting as a filmmaker, I think. So I really ought to get on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an interesting film. I think I'd recommend it even to those who I perhaps think couldn't handle it, because it's quite a funny film. It's very art house, but it's worth checking out, worth trying.
And cool. I think at least one of the things I noticed, which was quite strange, was just how much they sort of made Derek Jacobi look physically like Francis Bacon. It was a bit weird.
Yeah, it is a bit. And he fully embodies it physically as well. It's quite flamboyant, but also quite fierce, quite dangerous, quite unstable. Mm. That's a really terrific performance too.
Yeah, it is really, really amazing. And I think Bede can... Bede's turn anyway, so...
Of course.
off you go, buddy.
All right. For my first movie I want to talk about, I'll talk about a film that Marcy recommended me. It's the 1994 Anton Yegoyan film Exotica.
Yes.
Which is a film, it basically tells the story of four different characters who are sort of linked to this, I guess, this very high classy strip club called Exotica. And then the characters in the film are Christina, who's played by Mia Kirshner, and she works as a dancer at the club. And her main thing in the club is that she dresses up as a schoolgirl. And, you know, all the customers love that. And also at the strip club, who also works there, is Eric, who is played by Elias Cortez and his amazing Tommy Wiseau-esque hair. And he's the club's DJ, and he used to be in a relationship with Christina. And then there's one of Christina's customers named Francis, who's played by Bruce Greenwood, and he works in his daily life as a tax auditor. And then there's the fourth and final character of Thomas, who played by Don McKellar, who's sort of a gay pet shop owner who's hired Francis to do his accounts for his shop. And the thing about this film is you can't really say too much about the plot because it kind of gives a lot of things away. It's not really more of the story. It's more about the characters rather than than the film's plot. And while watching this, I do have to admit, for the first 30, 40 minutes of the film, I actually felt very cold by this film and very distant. And I wasn't really taken in by it. But it wasn't until probably just after that sort of 30, 40 minutes, the film started to slowly get to me in a way. And I was starting to get compelled by everything that was going on. And then eventually the film won me over and I was completely and utterly engaged by the story. And I think that's it's the way that the film is acted by the cast. And as well, the way that it's written and directed by Anton Yegoyan, it slowly reels you in. And I'm thinking to myself while watching the film, like, what's the deal with some of these characters to begin with? But it isn't until probably around the last half of the film that you kind of get a sense of who these characters really are and how they're all connected to each other in more ways than one. Then you just start getting really engaged by what's happening. And all the performances are amazing. Mia Kirshner is really great as Christina. Don McKellar does a really good job as Thomas. But for me, the two standout performances were Elias Cortez and Bruce Greenwood. Especially Bruce Greenwood, because I kind of have this joke with Bruce Greenwood. It's like anytime that Bruce Greenwood shows up in a movie, something bad's going to happen. And if you kind of see him in blockbuster movies, you'll know why. But this is definitely, like, I've always liked him as an actor, but this is like probably really made me appreciate him more because I never expected what type of an actor he was. And then just after watching this film, I was completely blown away by his performance. He is really amazing in this film. Yeah. And it helps that his character is one of the most complex in the film.
Mm.
And yeah, I want to say so much about why that is, but one of those things I can't. And I was really taken in by this film, and it's a film that sort of lingers with you long after when you watch it.
It does.
And it doesn't give you all the answers like up front or tell you who these characters are. It more does that as the movie progresses along. Mm. It's almost as like, you know, all the stuff of who these characters are, all that, which should be at the beginning of the film, is more like transplanted at the end of the film. And you sort of get these little reveals along the way towards the end of the movie who these characters are.
You don't get the entire picture, and you get to know them through what's happening now, through flashbacks. It's a very complex and interesting film. I discovered it probably about a year ago, maybe longer. I can't quite remember, but it was a subject of discussion for the first podcast that Sam and I ever did together in Why Haven't You Seen? And this was one of my picks for Why Haven't You Seen? And since I did see it back then, I've been a big fan of the movie. And this was something that I thought you would find interesting. It's something a bit different and it might challenge you a little bit.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, sort of my thinking behind recommending this to you. But I think it's an absolutely fantastic film. I love, you know, the performances, as you said, they're really great. I mean, Bruce Greenwood is such a great actor and he is really freaking so damn good in this movie.
Oh, he is. He really is. And it's beautifully directed and written as well. Like, the screenplay to the film is very multi-layered and complex.
It is. It's beautifully shot. I mean, the scenes in the club are really well done, and it's a strange club. Like, it's very surreal in what it is. And, you know, when Christina kind of takes the stage, it's almost hypnotic in a way. And,
it is.
You know, what she does, I mean, she doesn't, like, her clothes don't, it's not like a actual sort of strip that you're used to seeing in a movie. It's a lot more different than that, and the way she does it, it's just very, very strange, very hypnotic, and, you know, in a way it's disturbing because of how the people take to the whole schoolgirl thing.
Yeah.
Which is, there's a bit of, like, you can sort of feel there's a bit of an underlying message in there, but, what's his name? Elias Koteas, however you pronounce his name. He's fantastic. And I don't care what you say, I liked his hair. He doesn't have much of it now.
I couldn't stop. It's similar to, like, Ryan Gosling in Blue Valentine. I just could not stop looking at his hair. I don't know what it is.
It's because he doesn't have that much hair now.
I know. That was his Casey Jones hair. And
yeah, well, between this... between this and Crash, I think he lost his hair.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's an amazing and, you know, very underrated actor, and it's really interesting to see him in this kind of role, but he's so good and everybody really is. And it's this, I mean, I think it takes you that first sort of 20, 30 minutes to really engage in it because you don't really know what's going on. It kind of just pulls you into this thing. But as things slowly get revealed and you're learning about these characters and you get engaged with these characters, it's really well worth the trip.
I agree, and it's sort of a film that takes its time, and like I said, it sort of left me cold for a while, but it sort of gradually, it sort of reels
you can understand in. Why that is when you find out certain things.
Yeah, that's sort of like when you, like you say, once you sort of find out certain parts of who these characters are, that's when you think, oh, I understand why this film did that.
Yeah, exactly.
Now.
You're like, well, and that makes sense. I understand this motivation behind this and stuff like that.
And I could definitely see this movie, like I think it's a great film. I can definitely see myself loving it even more the more times I watch it because it is that type of film. I think
you definitely would get more out of it if, you know, upon a rewatch.
What I actually found interesting about this film is that I actually found this while I was sort of doing research on it, is that actually Roger Ebert actually wrote this film up as one of his great movie series.
Mm.
So this film is... like stands alongside like classics like Citizen Kane, Casablanca, The 400 Blows, The Godfather. So this is that type of movie. You sort of think back, oh, if Roger Ebert would write a great film, a great movie article about this film, then there has to be something to it. Exotica, definitely a very pleasant surprise. Wasn't sure what to expect of it. I guess I thought it would be like another like strip club movie.
Yeah, but, that's what you might think, but it's not at all.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it. So, but it's definitely, I think, and I actually did write it as my recommendation for this week, so you can check out what I wrote about it there. But it's definitely a great film that's worth checking out, and I definitely am interested to see more Anton Yegoyan films, because I think this is only my second one that I have seen.
Yeah, this was the second one that I'd seen, the other one being Where the Truth Lies from a few years back.
Oh, actually, third one, because I did see, I forgot about Where the Truth Lies, but I also saw Chloe as well, so this is
and Chloe.
My third one.
Yeah, that was the most recent one, yeah.
That was the most recent. I completely forgot about Where the Truth Lies.
Sorry. I forgot about the other one. So I gave this, my rating sits on a 4 out of 5, but it could change upon watching it again. My rating might go higher.
Yeah, I give it 4 out of 5 as well, and I do agree it might go up on repeating viewings. So, yeah.
And I don't know if Sam or Mike have seen this movie.
I saw it when I was about 14. And it's interesting what Bede said about, you might think it's another strip club movie. At 14, I was after another strip club movie, you know?
Yes.
we all were at that age. But I know I was.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm not ashamed of it. I'd be slightly ashamed of it now. But, yes. That's fine. I obviously hadn't discovered Egoyan at that time, but now I like his stuff that's sort of outside of the mainstream. I'm not so fond of Where the Truth Lies, and Chloe, I think, was pretty poor and not very, him. But I really love The Sweet Hereafter in particular, which is another film that sort of gets its hooks into you slowly. So what you say about it, makes me really want to go and revisit this one at last. So, yeah, definitely on the list.
Cool.
Yeah, I haven't seen Exotica, unfortunately. It's pretty expensive to get over here in the UK, but I have been meaning to see it because I like Egoyan. In fact, I really like Where the Truth Lies. I think that's a really underrated film. I would probably champion that as some of his best work. But, yeah, The Sweet Hereafter is also really good. I really want to get around to this one.
Yeah, you really should. And with that, we'll go back to you for the next one.
Okay, so next I'll do the film that you recommended me, Marcy. We'll do Everybody Dies But Me, which is a film that really everyone has to see for its title. I mean, what a title that is. it's just so much mystery to it. It's a statement for a film, basically. And it's a Russian film, it's a teen drama from 2008, and it revolves around three girls who learn that there will be a school disco, their first school disco on a Saturday night, and they start preparing for it in a very excited way, but soon their relationships, due to certain events, start breaking down. And that's really all I want to say about it, because of the way it plays out. And the thing is, these three girls, they are fickle, naive, and cruel, and that is exactly why it's a brilliant film, but I didn't like it, because I can't actually criticize it, because it's incredibly authentic, and these people feel very real. They are, they have a nasty side like people do, and that's portrayed very honestly, but that doesn't mean I need to like them. That doesn't mean I warmed to them in any way or found them interesting in any way. In fact, I just sat there constantly admiring the film, but thinking, I don't want to be around these people for another second if I can help it. And that is unfortunate, because I do think it's a very good film. I think it's put together in a way that is heartfelt, is honest, is artistic. I mean, teen movies really don't need to be artistic. They don't need to be concerned with shot structure and that sort of thing. I can't really think of many others that are, but this is a really beautiful film to look at. In fact, I don't think it's on DVD. It certainly isn't in the UK, I don't think. But so I watched it on YouTube, and I was amazed at how just stunning it looks. Because when you watch something on YouTube, you think low quality, but it looked amazing. I was absorbed into it aesthetically. It's also really interesting that the film makes use of a lot of handheld cameras, which are so often intrusive or alienating. They remind you that you're watching a film when it takes away from the drama. But here it just felt observational and natural. It kind of flowed with the characters' movement, and the three characters have distinctly different movement down to their personalities, which are all very developed and very individual. I think it has fantastic performances all the way through. I can't pronounce any of the actors' names, so I shan't embarrass myself. But the three leads are all completely convincing in these very well-written roles, complex, multi-layered characters. But I just didn't like them. I just thought if I knew you at school, I would slap you. I would move schools to be away from you. And I understand that that's kind of the point, that that's who these characters are, and you're meant to just be in their lives for a short period of time and watch them just fall apart as people do in high school. But I just, it was to such an honest degree, and that's so commendable, that I just thought, I can't stand this anymore. Maybe that's a glowing recommendation to some. Certainly, like I said, it's not something I can complain about. The fact that the film does that is fantastic, but it doesn't mean that I really like it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean,
I would definitely consider that a glowing recommendation.
Yeah.
The idea that it put you off in such a sort of visceral way, because it means it hit you.
Mm.
You know,
yeah, no,
and I think it does. I also think the performances are extraordinary.
Yeah.
Olga Shevelova, who plays the young blonde girl Vika, I just thought was
just
astonishingly
astounding.
Good.
She really is.
I've since seen her in another Russian film, which I didn't like very much, but in which she is equally brilliant. So she's a name to keep an eye on.
I think she has the hardest character as well, because she's quite weak compared to the other two, who are very outgoing, very strong in their personality, very visceral. They really hit you. And she is a character who could easily, I think, be manipulated by the screenplay. She could be like the message of the film, in a way. She could be picked on, but she isn't. I think they all make mistakes, some of which they actively make themselves, some of which are made for them, and I think she does have a very hard job, and it's quite an incredible performance. They're all so naturalistic. That's the thing, you can't tell they're acting for a second, which is extraordinary for this sort of film.
I think, like, for me especially, the film felt so real, even though it's like, you know, it's set somewhere completely different. It felt very much like how high school actually is and can be. And there's so many people you really don't like. There's, you know, when you're with your friends and this kind of crap happens. And, you know, I guess, like, I sort of said in my review originally that, like, you know, it's been compared to, say, Kids or 13 in the way that...
Mm-hmm.
Those things are, and it is in a way, because those characters, you don't like them. They're assholes.
No.
And they're doing things that they really shouldn't be doing, and it'll, you know, it's not a very long film, but I think it felt really, like, in that short running time, I think it managed to fit in everything, you know, it fit everything into that.
Complete.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at. And, you know,
it's interesting that you bring up Kids, actually, very briefly, because when I watched the film on YouTube, the tag that the user who had uploaded it put there said, if you liked Kids, you'll love this. The thing is, I hated Kids. I think it's a hateful film. I despise it on every level. Mm. The thing about that film is, nobody who is writing or directing that cares about those characters. It's just saying, here's a bunch of stuff. And I don't care how real that is. The thing about Everybody Dies But Me is that... the filmmakers, the people behind it, are saying, okay, even though these characters are flawed, even though they do nasty things, they're learning. They're allowed to do things. And that sort of thing. You never get that from Kids. It's just hateful. This film, I think, is quite compassionate when it needs to be. Even when it's provoking you, even when you're thinking, God, I hate these people. The reason you hate them is because they're rounded and they're real, and someone put attention into making sure they felt that way. I think the Kids kind of parallel is... unfair in a way. I can see where it comes from. I can see why it's valid in terms of the themes of the film, but I think it's really unfair in terms of the execution. And those who hate Kids, like me, with that tag might be put off seeing it, and they really shouldn't be. Because although I found this film very difficult and didn't like the characters at all, I am going to recommend it to people, because the fact that I didn't like them is why it's so good.
The
other thing I was going to say is you mentioned right up top how great the title is, and it is. But the title is actually kind of indirectly the reason that we're discussing this film right now, because I saw it at the 2008 London Film Festival because of its title, for no other reason.
Mm-hmm.
I was just sort of looking through, picking my films, and I went, that's an awesome title. This movie cannot suck. Give me a ticket. And I went to see it. I was knocked sideways by it. I thought it was tremendous. And then, yeah, this year I recommended it to Marcy, who then went out and saw it when I found out that it was on YouTube. So it's kind of the fact that I had a strong reaction to that title is pretty much why we're having this conversation.
And it is testament to the fact that, yeah, films can be sold on their title, and this one absolutely is. There's just so much mystery there, and I think when that line is spoken in the film as well, towards the very end, with all that has come before, it packs a hell of a punch, and you think, yeah, of course that's the title. Mm. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it makes sense, and that's a big reason. As soon as, you know, Sam says this title, I was like, oh, yeah, I want to see that. I don't know what it's about, but that's an awesome title. You know, in a way, it's always refreshing to see a film that is just, it's honest, it's raw, it's not sugar-coated, it's not trying to be funny, because, you know, things like this aren't generally funny. It's realistic, and sometimes it's good to see something like that rather than have it be funny and sugar-coated and not like high school whatsoever.
I mean, I think that's, I've said this before, but that's something that really is a hallmark of European and Eurasian teen films.
Yeah,
much more so than American. America does have a couple that kind of confront the darker side, but even something like 13 is very sugar-coated and doesn't ring as true as this. There's a sort of a willingness to address the fact that being a teenager is not fun, I think, in non-American teen movies that I really appreciate. Because I wouldn't go back to being 18 if you paid me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I really appreciate that in European cinema at the moment. Mm. I think it's a really great thing.
Yeah, I'm just thinking now about kind of what score I would give it, because technically, in terms of the script, the performances, the direction, everything about the film is perfect. I love its honesty. I love how raw it is. I just didn't like the characters. And I understand that's partly what I bring to it as well. And it's also the point, and it's also a recommendation. So I suppose on a critical level, it's somewhere around a 4 out of 5. But on a personal level, it's much less, like a 2.5 or 3. People should definitely take the time to see this film. And it's not very long, and it's on YouTube, so there's no excuses. They absolutely should see it.
Yeah, I gave it 4.5 out of 5 upon that initial viewing. And, yeah, we basically recommended it to you because it was something that was fresh in my mind when we set this up. And I thought, you know, anybody who watches it will get something out of it. And it has a cool title.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's that movie. And, Sam, back to you.
Yeah. Okay, well, I tell you what, I'll address what Mike gave me. And since we're talking about cool titles, let's talk about Amsterdam.
It's so good.
It's just the title, such a great title. Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful title. And the title, again, is the reason I picked it up. I found an old, you know, rental VHS in a charity shop a couple of years back. I've never got around to watching it before now, as is the case with a lot of my videotapes. And I just, again, thought, that is an awesome title. This movie cannot be that bad. You know, it can't entirely suck. They called it Amsterdam. And it's basically a thriller with some slasher inflections about a killer who is murdering people in the canals of Amsterdam. He's a diver, and he's knifing people to death in Amsterdam, and there's a cop who is after him. It's really that simple. And for all its simplicity, I really rather enjoyed it. I'm not going to sit here and call it a masterpiece or anything. It's definitely got moments where you can hear the plot-o-matic clunking away a little bit, particularly with the romance between, oh god, I forget the actor's name right now.
Who are you looking for? Yeah, that's right. It plays the cop.
Yeah,
Eric Bristow.
Ulf Staples and Monique van der Ven, who more art housey movie fans will probably know from some of Paul Verhoeven's early films, particularly Turkish Delight. And that's, yeah, that's a perfectly nice relationship. It's well done and all, but it's a bit, you know, turning the wheels of the plot. But the action is executed really, really well. It's occasionally thrilling. It's got some nice little moments throughout it. It's well shot. It's very blue, I've got to say. At times I was thinking, oh, somebody's seen a Michael Mann film or three. But I like the sort of iconic depiction of the killer in his diving suit with his diving knife. That works really nicely. There's a really good attack scene underwater. I got myself a bit trapped because there's a very nice sort of double reveal towards the end of who the killer is. I was like, I knew it. I knew it. I knew it was that guy from the moment. Oh, right. It's not him.
Yeah.
which they definitely got me, but in a way I'd kind of prefer if they had gone with the kind of the cliche because,
yeah.
Because the actual ending's something of an anticlimax.
Right, okay.
Because it's just some dude. and, you know, that kind of lacks punch, I think. Particularly sure. When it comes 10 minutes after this brilliant action sequence, which is this fantastic boat chase through the canals of Amsterdam. Easily the standout section of the film. I think it's about 7 minutes long. It's brilliantly choreographed, really inventive, ends in a needless explosion, but, you know, it's an action movie, fine. And, yeah, that's just really terrific. I would put it up there with that boat chase at the beginning of The World Is Not Enough as, mm-hmm. you know, really terrific boat chase stuff. And actually, there's a couple of moments where I thought, oh, the people who did The World Is Not Enough saw this movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
A couple of very similar moments. Sorry?
Yeah. No, I thought the exact same thing. It's very similar in places.
But, you know, very impressively done. Is it a particular classic? No, not really. It's hard to tell anything about the performances because while the dubbing is very good, it is still dubbing. Though I did appreciate the fact that they dubbed the actors with accents. Yeah, so they clearly got Dutch actors. I don't know whether it's the original people, but they clearly got Dutch actors dubbing the dialogue. So at least you get accented English. And it fits actually the mouth movements very, very well. I wonder if they did some tailoring of the script in order to make it fit a bit better. And so, as much as I would usually swear off dubbed films, if you have to watch this one dubbed, it's probably not too bad of a choice, but it does make it hard to tell anything really about the performances. But overall, I mean, it's not going to become my next favourite thriller or anything, but I had a great time with it. The slasher stuff works quite nicely, even though it's not overemphasised. There's some terrific action scenes. And the character stuff works quite well, you know. It's a really solid little thriller, and thanks for the recommendation, basically.
No, that's fine. I mean, the reason I recommend it to you, basically, is just because I think it's a lot of fun. And we often talk about movies that are very serious, but we also talk about horror movies, and I thought this was like a nice blend. It's just something that's really straightforward, slick, enjoyable. It's interesting that you talk about the print being very blue and you make the reference to Michael Mann. I think that may be something just to do with watching the film on VHS, because actually right. I think it's a very colour-coded film. In fact, what I think this owes the most to, in a way, in certain ways, is giallo. And when I watched the DVD, okay.
Yeah,
I certainly got that in... I got that in spades when I watched the DVD, which is very colour-coded, very seedy. The first murder sequence takes place in a district where basically there's a prostitute, a man picks her up, if I remember that rightly, and the way that's directed, the lights and that sort of thing is very giallo-inflected. And I think actually
there's a couple of things
about...
I forgot to... Sorry.
No, do carry on.
There's a couple of things I forgot to mention in that first scene is terrific. That's really good stuff. The first murder is really nicely rendered. And then there's a brilliant, very, very dark shot of the body being dragged off and the trail of blood. And a fantastic sequence with a tourist boat straight after that, which is just incredibly striking. And again, I can totally see the giallo thing with that because you've got the blood being dragged across the boat there. And that's very giallo, very Argento, very Fulci. Sort of thing.
Argento is the big thing I got from this, just from the colours, from the way the murders were choreographed, even in the bad ending. I think it is very giallo inflected. And the way I actually described the film when I reviewed it, I've yet to publish this review, but I've got it just in front of me here, is it's basically a remake of Jaws, but with a psychopath instead of a shark. And it is kind of, it's a film basically about, although it has the cop stuff going on, which I think is very well done as well, it's very entertaining. The main character is quite, he kind of hooks you. I don't know that you necessarily like him that much, but he's certainly engaging. But I think it is a film that has suspense, and it does mount terror in a very specific way. And it is very stylish, it's very exciting. Like you say, that boat chase is terrific. I don't think it's a classic, but I do think it's much better than people seem to think it is, the people that have seen it, which is very few people. I want it to be rediscovered in a way because, you know, it's overlong and there are subplots that don't work, but, you know, that's giallo, and this is a giallo-inflected film. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, so do I.
I think that's really all we can say about it, really. I mean, what would you score it?
I think it's a 3 out of 5, really. But a nice solid one, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd give it the same.
Cool. I haven't seen it. I hadn't even heard of it. So
I haven't seen it and haven't heard of it, but I do like the title.
I know.
Yeah, I'm almost convinced to go see it now.
Yes.
So we're going back to me. And I'll go with what Bede recommended me, and he recommended a movie called Once, which was written and directed by John Carney, and it's basically a film set over a few days, which focuses on this relationship between a guy and a girl. And they're brought together by music, and it sort of develops, you know, this sort of relationship, and then the relationship with music and that kind of stuff. it is pretty simple in, you know, what it's about. I think what sort of sets the film out is that it is done mostly with music, and the fact that it really just takes place over these few days and what happens to these characters and how their relationships develop over, you know, everything, because they're basically, you know, they're not well-off people. You've got a guy that busks in the street and then he works part-time, you know, fixing vacuum cleaners, and the girl is an immigrant. They're in Dublin, I believe. And it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, they meet, things happen, and they sort of, you know, share this music that they both make together, and that kind of brings them to actually make things with each other, and that's pretty much it. That's what happens. There's... you know, it's hard to explain. They sort of develop something very close in these few days, and, you know, it is kind of heartbreaking as it ends, even though it's not really, in a way. But, you know, it is really represented by the music in the movie.
Mm.
I guess that's the best way I can describe it. I wasn't really sure what to think of this. I hadn't seen it. I had really not had too much of an intention to see it. I wasn't sure if it would be my cup of tea, really.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons why I recommended it to you for this podcast, because I remember back when we did the soundtracks episode, and I talked about how much I love the soundtrack to this film was one of my all-time favorites. I remember that both you and Nick hadn't seen the movie, and you actually thought, oh, I don't really have any interest in seeing it. I thought, I'm going to get you to watch this movie one day.
Yeah,
and,
well,
and as soon as this podcast came up, I said, I'm going to make Marcy watch this.
Yeah, and it was almost in a way that I hadn't heard the best things about it from some people, so I wasn't really sure. But, you know, it turned out for the most part to be pretty good, pretty enjoyable.
Marcy, who are these people? Because I want to hunt them down.
Yes, who's been lying to you?
Yes.
A lot of people.
Indeed. Marcy, this has been, like, on tons of people's top 10 lists of that year.
Yeah, it's strange. But, you know, for the most part, I enjoyed the movie. I did take quite a lot of notes, apparently. But I felt like, especially because the strong point is the music, I felt it was very genuine and emotional. Some of the songs were brilliant. I can't think of the titles at the moment. I need to get the soundtrack and listen to them.
I'll have to send you a copy of the soundtrack, Marcy, because I do have it, so I'll send it to you.
Yeah, you should. So, yeah, there's that. I think sort of, you know, the initial meeting at the beginning of the film, it feels normal. Like, this is what happens. You know, when you see the character of the guy, like, he's busking and some guy's giving him shit. And it's like, you know, I see this all the time. It feels very real. And, you know, the music that they make, it's emotional. It's the core of the movie. It's really well shot. You know, there's a natural chemistry between the two characters. And, you know, they kind of look like the people that you'd probably avoid in the street, but they're ones that, you know, on appearance, you sort of wonder, are they crazy? But then, you know, once you get to know them, you find out they're actually quite normal. And there's always, like, there's this great sort of awkwardness when they're invited into each other's homes because they don't know each other that well. And it's kind of like, yeah, if I went to somebody's house, I don't really know. I'd really stand there like an idiot. And that kind of thing. I mean, that rings true. Some stuff sort of took me out of it. Like, you know, they don't have any money, but suddenly, oh, yeah, we're going to do this and this to do this other thing. I just thought it was a bit silly. And there's a bit in the bank, which I was just like, facepalm, that's silly. But yeah, I mean, everything else was really good. It has this kind of bittersweet ending that's just beautiful. It's the way it's done, I think it's just great. So yeah.
That ending made me cry, Marcy, and I'm not ashamed to admit that.
Yeah, I think it made someone else here cry too.
I'm a big girl's blouse, what are you gonna do about it?
I mean, it's funny that you can
put a third person in there too.
It's strange I didn't cry because I'm a very emotional person when it comes to things like this, but I didn't because in a way I'm like, you know what? These two people are going to have, you know, things are going to be good for them in a way.
Make beautiful music together.
Well, they, you know, they're sort of like this really sweet thing that happens and, you know, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing in a way, but yeah. I mean, I think my score for this was, what did I give it? I don't even remember. it was either 3.5 or 4. I think it was 3.5. I probably need to watch it again to get more out of it, I think. Which I did buy on Blu-ray, and it looks very nice on Blu-ray. It sounds very nice on Blu-ray.
Cool.
So that was a very good blind buy.
I'm kind of sad now, Marcy, because I did say if you didn't like the movie, you could always send the Blu-ray my way.
Yeah, sorry. I think I'll be keeping the Blu-ray. Which I know that's disappointing for you. Let me see. What was my score? Yeah, 3.5 out of 5, but it'll probably bump up to a 4 upon watching it again. But it's a very enjoyable, it's a fun movie. It's, you know, it's got all different elements, but, you know, of course the strong part is the soundtrack, because it is about music. If you're going to have a movie about music and have a shit soundtrack, well, that's just dumb. So, you know, of course it's got to be good there, but it was interesting to check it out and wonder why I sort of questioned watching it to begin with.
Indeed, Barcy, indeed. Mm.
So, yeah, I thank you, Bede, for the recommendation of Once.
Hell yeah.
I don't know if there's much else I can really say, because it is a simple... It's simple. It has this message. It's not complex. It's not difficult to understand. But, yeah, I definitely just want to give that soundtrack a really good listen.
Yeah, it's just a good old-fashioned, gentle love story, really.
Yeah, and I think my favourite song is probably the one that she sings at night when she goes and gets the batteries.
Oh, yeah.
And then she sings down the street. Yeah. But I'm like...
My favorite. Thank you, I couldn't remember the time.
Yeah, and I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't be walking down the rough streets by myself at night with headphones in. But, you know, that's just me looking at it in that respect.
Well, of course, my two favourite songs in the movie, of course, you know, the classic Falling Slowly, which they see in the music shop,
mm-hmm.
which is, like, which won the Oscar, deservedly. And also When Your Mind Is Made Up, which is the song they sing in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a great song as well. That's my personal favourite of the songs on the soundtrack. But all the songs are amazing.
Yeah, they really are.
I've got to say, I got misty-eyed when she was doing The Hill on her own on the piano. I got a little something in my eye then. but then, as we've established, I'm a big girl's blouse.
There you are.
Indeed. Yes. Mike,
I love the film pretty much. That's all I have to say. I mean, the soundtrack is fantastic. That main song that won the Oscar, Falling Slowly, is just beautiful, and it's just a really nicely observed, gentle film, very classical. The thing it makes me think of, and the thing that all these films make me think of in terms of it being about two people meeting and just kind of walking and talking, it reminds me of Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. Mm-hmm. Very different films in terms of what the characters do and theme and even location as well, but it's just a very classical mold that seems to work really well in movies, and this is a great one to add to the canon. It's really, really enjoyable, really moving, really solid.
Mm.
Again, I think it's a quite an honest film in that it doesn't indulge, thank God, in that most horrible of cliches, the chase to the airport. I've got to stop him getting on that plane. No, you can't do that. And I'm so glad they don't. It means so much more that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it does.
I'd have wanted to slap the movie if it did. Mm. It's a very heartfelt, very honest, and very well judged film, because, I mean, it knows that these people don't have the best lives, but there's still a playfulness about it and a humour about it. You know, sitting on the bus doing a broken hearted Hoover fix a sucker guy. it's lovely. And by the way, thank you. I got that title right.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a terrific film. I loved it the first time I saw it at the screening at Raindance. I loved it last time I saw it, you know, a couple of months ago on DVD. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
I agree.
I think that's all we have to say about that. And back to Bede.
Alrighty, my next film, I definitely want to talk about a film that Mike recommended me. I know he sort of had a bit of trouble trying to decide what film he wanted to watch, so I had to give him a little bit of help by giving him a list I actually wrote a while ago on Movie Fan Central called the, I think it was the top 25 films I've actually haven't seen.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I think this movie was number one on the list.
It was, yeah.
And that film, of course, is the classic Lawrence of Arabia, which I'm ashamed to admit I had not seen until a few days ago.
Shame. The film,
I know it's. I'm
this is why we terrible. Call him terrible.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of movies. Yeah. Oh well, well,
you but there are very few Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, there's very few. Well, let's just say Hollywood doesn't make, or even films in general, no matter what country you're from, just don't make films like Lawrence of Arabia anymore. I guess, well, pretty much everyone knows what the story's about, but I think just to give a refresher, it kind of tells the story, the true story of T.E. Lawrence, who's played by Peter O'Toole. And he's sort of in World War II. He's kind of a misfit, so he just kind of does his own thing into Cairo. But then he sort of is hired by the Arab Bureau to go off to to Arabia. And
you're
to
doing find... that whole "I can't describe a plot to save my life" thing right now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm saying he goes off to Arabia to assess the prospects of Prince Faisal, who's played by Alec Guinness. And eventually he sort of, once he's over there, he sort of becomes involved in their revolt against the Turks. And eventually he sort of, with his expertise, they sort of look to him, and he sort of leads the armies and all that against the Turks. And it basically sort of follows his campaign during World War II. And I think it's a great film. I wasn't blown away by it, but I do have a feeling, though, it's a film I'd probably get a lot more out the more times that I see it. But it's a beautifully shot film. It like, there aren't that many directors like David Lean anymore who use the widescreen so effectively. Every shot is amazing. Even though it's sort of in the desert, but it just looks stunning. And it's also, it's a very long film. It goes for about 3.5 hours. 3 hours and 40 minutes. But it doesn't feel too long. Some parts I thought dragged a little, but could have used a bit of tightening here and there. But it's still a well-crafted film. Peter O'Toole is amazing. He does a really fantastic job in the film of Lawrence. And it's funny, though, that this was actually his film debut. And the only thing he actually did prior to this film was just mostly theatre work. But all the supporting cast are really great. You sort of got Alec Guinness, who plays Prince Faisal, Anthony Quinn. But one of the standout performances for me in the film was Omar Sharif, who plays a character named Sharif Ali, who sort of becomes a friend of Lawrence during the course of the film. And he's really fantastic. I don't think this was his film debut, but from what I remember, but if it was, it's a great debut. He really, every time he's on screen, he's very magnetic. And with Peter O'Toole, he's, as I said before, he's amazing. But I didn't realize how much of an interesting character of how he played that, the character of Lawrence was in the film. He's a very complex character. And he's very interesting, and just his motivations of why he's sort of helping out Prince Faisal and his men, and also during the course of what happens to him during the film, he does it really perfectly. And maybe he does look a little too pretty for the film, but you know, this is Hollywood films of the 50s and 60s, so, you know, making him look dirtied up wasn't a main issue back, wasn't, you know, high priority back then, but... It really is a great film. It's a great adventure. There's a lot of great moments in the film. The score by Maurice Jarre is classic. And I have to admit, I did not know where the score... I've actually heard the score many times before, but I never realized it was actually from this film. So it was it blew my mind once I heard it. But it is a classic film. Not an amazing film, I have to be honest, and... It, that doesn't mean I hated the film. I think it's a great film, but it just didn't blow me away as I thought it was going to be. But I do have a feeling I probably will get a lot more out of it the more times I watch it. But I think I might wait until, because I hear that they're doing the Blu-ray for this film as I speak at this moment, so, and it's coming out next year. So I'm really looking forward to that. And just this, because I saw the film on DVD. And this was from the special edition that came out, I think, a couple of years ago. And the restoration just for the DVD looked amazing. Like, you'd think it was made today. That's how good it looked. And I can only imagine just how amazingly the film is going to look on Blu-ray. So, yeah, that's basically all I have to really say about Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, what's more can be said about this film? Like, it is a classic, and there's no question of that. But like I said, do I think it's an amazing film? Not really personally, but I do think it's a great film with two equally amazing performances from both Peter O'Toole and Omar Sharif, and an absolutely superb direction from David Lynn. So yes, that's basically it, really. What are you guys' thoughts on the classic that is Lawrence of Arabia?
Well, obviously, I loved it to recommend it to you. I think it's a great film. I do actually think you're right in the fact that it's a film that will grow on you over time. I think whenever you get past the 2.5 hour mark with a movie you've never seen before, you start to feel a little bit distanced from it, unless it's really exceptional. That's a long time to sit and watch a film. Obviously, you feel more comfortable with it on a second watch.
Yeah, I think that might have been it, because like, it wasn't a film that I had never seen before, even though I did want to see it. But I have to admit, like, the fact that it is over 3.5 hour, nearly 4 hour film would have been one of the reasons why I sort of didn't love it as much, because it's a long film, and there are moments in that did drag for me. But I think the more times that I will watch it, I think I will appreciate it much more, regardless of how long the film is.
Yeah, and you mentioned the score as well, which is obviously absolutely amazing, and it just always stirs these emotions in me. That's fantastic. I also want to mention quickly the cinematography by Freddie Young, who shot quite a few of David Lean's films, Dr. Zhivago most notably. He did a Bond film as well, and he just makes the film look so stunning. That DVD is a really good restoration. Just the colours and the lighting is extraordinary. Of course, you know, David Lean, like you say, employed widescreen like nobody else. To be honest, there isn't a screen wide enough to contain a David Lean film, especially this one. It just looks stunning. You get so involved in the film just because of the location and the fact that it feels so exotic and so much like this rousing adventure, and you're so involved with the character because the performances are so amazing. I think Steven Spielberg describes this as a miracle of a film. And I agree, because it's very rare that you get everything come together to create an experience that is so absorbing and so just cinematic. There is no other way to describe this film. It is a work of cinema. It's a masterful work of cinema. I adore it, pretty much.
Great.
Well, I haven't seen it for a long time.
Might have to be a rewatch for you, Marty.
Yeah, I have been meaning to, although the idea of this coming to Blu-ray, I'm like, yeah, maybe I'll wait for Blu-ray, because that'll be quite an experience.
Yeah, that's going to be a mind-bending experience. I think I might just devote a day to that, watch it three times.
I think, because didn't the film come out in 62, was it? 1962?
Yeah, 62.
Yeah, right. I think that's the reason why it's coming out next year, is to celebrate the film's 50th anniversary. So I think that's the main reason why they're waiting for it to come out next year instead.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I agree, and I will definitely buy the Blu-ray, and I have a feeling that that my rating for it will definitely sort of go up on more repeating viewers. I'm sort of going back and forth between whether giving it a 4-star rating or maybe a 4.5. I sort of just need to sort of null it over a little bit more, but I do have a feeling it will go up on repeated viewings.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 5 out of 5 for me. It's one of those classics that, for me personally, holds up to its reputation and just gets better on each watch.
Please don't throw things. I haven't seen it.
You're a bastard, sir. I can't believe you haven't seen this film. It shocks me to my core. Okay, never mind.
I just never got to it.
Maybe it'll be a blind Blu-ray by next year, then.
Mm-hmm. It has to be.
Because the only copy I've actually got here is on VHS.
I don't think the VHS.
I think probably wouldn't cut it at this stage.
Yeah, I think so too.
I mean, it's widescreen at least, but you know, still.
Yeah, but it's, you know, VHS.
No, I know.
But I guess that's mainly all I have to really say about Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, It's a classic. It's a great film in its own right. Well, in my opinion, anyway. And it's definitely something that every movie lover should see. Like, it's one of the definitive films. You can't go through life as a film buff or as a film geek with at least seeing this movie, even if it's only once.
Says the person who hadn't seen it.
That's quite true.
Yes.
We should be filming this on our webcams just to see the shame in my face at the moment.
Well, Beach should have felt shame because he hadn't seen it until now.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I'm in the club now, Marcy, so... I have
Yes, I think it's probably a bit early for you to start throwing things at me, given that you only just got around to it.
Mm.
Yes. Don't worry, there's still a lot more movies, like, great movies that I still need to get around to seeing. Like, I think the next major one I need to get around to watching is On the Waterfront, so that'll be one that I need to finally check out as well. But I think we'll move along. Mike, I guess it's your turn again.
Yeah, I think it's on to the final film. So it's Sam's recommendation, which is a film called XXY, which I'd heard of before you recommended it to me, but I didn't really know anything what it was about. So the basic plot, and again, I don't want to give much away here, I'll just give the basic character outline, is that there is a character called Alex, who is 15 years old, hermaphrodite born, with both with masculine features and feminine features and body parts. It's never made quite clear kind of what side the character lies on. There the talk of the medication, but it's all played really naturalistically and really subtle. And Alex's parents have moved with her from Argentina to a small village by the sea in Uruguay, and basically what happens there is they want to escape from the life that they had. They want to escape from the way she's looked at and the prejudice and that sort of thing, and just build a new life. And it's just basically a film about characters interacting. And there are films that have been made on this subject before, but never quite as well as XXY, I think. I really, really like this film. It's just so delicate and so poetic and quiet, and it just really naturally observed. And I think a lot of it actually has to do with the setting. I've never seen a film that is kind of, it's really weird to say about a film dealing with this subject matter that you loved The Fish. But I think there's a lot in the story, both literally and metaphorically, to do with sea life. The character that I'm just looking at some of the information about the film here, that there's the family name Kraken, which obviously refers to the mythical sea monster, keeps being brought up. Alex keeps clownfish in an aquarium. They are obviously hermaphrodite fish. They are all born male, and then some turn into females. And there's just this constant reflection between where the characters live and what they do, and the situation that Alex is in. And that's really interesting. And in fact, the opening credits are these really striking kind of underwater shots of just these creatures. It's really hard to explain, but I just loved the atmosphere that the film created and the feeling that it created through the setting and through what the characters did for a living. It's just really beautifully observed. I loved the colour of the film. It's a really nice shade of blue, in a way, a very light blue, though. It just has a really... It's a film that literally feels like it's by the edge of the sea. I know these are really odd things to be saying, but it's such an unusual film in the way it's shot and the atmosphere it creates. And I think it's a very honest portrayal of what it must be like to be born this way and grow up under a lot of pressure, obviously go through a lot of operations, scans, see doctors, be bullied, have people look at you in a different way, be in a home and a family like this. I think it's very well observed, very in a very subtle way, and it's a film that has something to say. But most of all, it is just about the interactions between the characters, which, again, I think are really beautifully observed. There are times where you feel awkward. There are times where you recognise something. There are times where you're made to think what that must be like for that character, because obviously it's very hard to put yourself in their shoes. And at the end of the day, it's just a very beautiful film, a film that doesn't contrive anything, that doesn't force you in any one direction or force you to make an opinion. It just... says, here are a bunch of people and here's what they're going through. And by the ending, I was really moved by it. And I find it very hard to explain, actually. I've been trying to write a mini review all week and it hasn't really been going well. But I'm just really glad that you recommended this to me, Sam, because I think it's a really delicate, beautiful, well-observed little drama, and it perfectly formed in its own way.
I'm glad you liked it so much. I mean, obviously, I'm made up. But the reason I kind of picked it for you was that it's quite an unusual film about quite an unusual person, and it is beautifully acted, I think. I just thought those were things that you would appreciate.
Yeah.
I do want to flag up in a way that you kind of haven't there, the performances, the three central performances, which I think are fantastic all round. Inez Efron as Alex, who is or was actually quite considerably older than the character. I think she's about 23 in the film. But utterly convincing as a 15-year-old, and particularly as somebody, because it's really about Alex's and another kid's sort of sexual awakening to a certain degree,
yeah,
and how complicated that is by the questions about Alex's gender as well as her sexuality. You know, if she's interested in a boy, is she a gay man? Or is she a straight woman? It's really, I think that's kind of the most interesting part of it for me, is the idea of it almost just as a teen movie. And also the dynamic with Ricardo Darín, who is probably the most famous Argentinian actor, certainly in this country. For this and for Nine Queens he's in, and The Secret in Their Eyes, and a film that was at LFF last year called Carancho, which needs to get a release. And he's terrific, as well as Alex's father, who's kind of really trying to be supportive and understand his child, but in the same way that any parent doesn't understand their 15-year-old, you know, really struggles with it. And Martin Piriansky as Alex's friend, or a friend of the family who is staying with them. And that the dynamic between him and Alex, I think, is really, really fascinating, because all of the sort of the sexuality of the film kind of comes out in that relationship in all its complexity. And one particular scene in a treehouse is incredibly striking and quite troubling as well, in a great way. I just think it's a fascinating film on so many levels, but yeah, particularly as you say, on a sort of interpersonal and a performance level.
I actually thought that character of Alvaro, the son of the family friends, was really one of the most interesting characters in the film. I think the way he reacted to being among these people, as fascinating as your central character is, and you're obviously meant to be focusing on them, I thought his interactions with both Alex and his father, there's a scene at the end of the film where he sits down with his father and says, "Do you like me?" And the father says, "Well, you're my son." And he says, "Well, no, let's talk seriously here." And the father pretty much says no. And it's just such a striking and raw scene. I thought, God, that really hit me. And I thought he was really interesting. And that is the relationship with his father, which is really underplayed until that moment, was really unusual. And really, I could watch a film just... That's the thing. In a way, even though you are meant to be focused on Alex and everyone else is a side character and some of them are less developed or less interesting, you could really make a film from any one of these characters' perspectives, because it's such an interesting dynamic that they all have together. And that's rare for a film as well. It's really well observed.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of the score,
of you guys... Sorry?
No, I was just going to think of a score, but I want to think about this for a bit more to carry on.
Well, I was just going to ask you if either Marcy or Bede have caught this one.
Nope.
Nope.
I'll go straight to
that
the score. It's a pretty solid 4 out of 5 for me.
I haven't seen it in a little while, but I gave it a 5 at the time and put it at number 3 on my list that year.
Wow.
Okay. I really loved it. I thought it was terrific. I think it was behind No Country for Old Men and Grace Is Gone that year.
Right.
But it's a really terrific film, and I would highly recommend it to people. Does that make it my go?
Yes, it is your turn, Sam. Give us your final. Okay.
My final one was recommended to me by Marcy, and it's the Talking Heads concert film Stop Making Sense, which, unaccountably, I hadn't seen. Marcy, do you want to maybe let us know what your thinking was on this one?
I think the main thing was to give you something different, and this is very different. It's not really, like, the standard thing because it is a concert film.
Mm-hmm.
That was the main thing behind that, and I also got to give a shout out to AJ who helped me come up with the pick for you. But well, I
certainly
think
you and I have talked about music before a little bit as well, and you know, mm-hmm. I'm a bit of a music bod. But I actually haven't really discovered Talking Heads, not because I haven't wanted to. It's just, again, like films, it's one of the many bands that I just haven't got around to, despite I think I've got a couple of their LPs in my vinyl collection, actually. And on the musical front, total success, by the way. Really want to go out and buy some Talking Heads albums, even a Tom Tom Club album, because I really like their track as well. Towards the end of the film. It's a fantastically good gig. The music is sharp and varied. David Byrne's on fantastic form with that one-of-a-kind voice. Nobody sounds quite like David Byrne. And it's nice to hear a set that goes a bit deeper than the big hits, you know. So you've got Psycho Killer, you've got Once in a Lifetime, you've got Burning Down the House, which is a storming performance in particular. But it goes a bit deeper. And there wasn't a track that I didn't like. There wasn't a moment that I was like, oh, come on, get to the good stuff, you know, in the way that with a band that you really like sometimes, there's, particularly if you're watching a gig at home, there's more of a temptation. Like if you're watching the Portishead NYC concert, you're kind of going, yeah, but I want to hear Over. And you kind of skip to that. And because I was unfamiliar with Talking Heads, and because I had to sit and watch it for this, I kind of really got absorbed in the music and in the gig. On the other hand, while I think it's a very good gig, very well filmed, I'm not sure that I feel it's really much more than that. And people talk about it in these terms that it's meant to be some sort of shining masterpiece. So some sort of, you know, groundbreaking thing. And I'm not sure I buy that. It's a terrific gig, very well shot, and I'll definitely go back to it. And, you know, I'll almost certainly pick up the album at some point. But as much as I like the stagecraft of it, I don't think and there are some nice shots as well. I don't think it's as essential as a film as it is as a gig, as an album. I think you would get probably as good an experience, or for me, I would probably get as good an experience just listening to the record, as I did from watching the film. I think maybe that's because it is, as you said, just a concert film. There's nothing exploring the personalities or the making of the gig itself. There's no sort of behind the scenes. There's not even really a privileged view. You're really just watching the gig, and that's great because it's a terrific gig. But as cinema, I feel like it could be doing more to justify being cinema.
Do you see what I mean?
In a way.
Yeah, it's a terrific album that I'm not sure I needed to watch rather than listen to. I think is, despite the stagecraft being very good at times.
I mean, yeah. That's fair enough, but I think it's very absorbing in everything. Like, it's watching it, it's so much fun. And, you know, I find that with a lot of things that are, like, you know, when you watch concerts, they're not as well shot. You're not really brought into it. And this one, I think, really does. And it, like you said, it has some fantastic shots. It's really well shot. And...
Oh, it is. You know, I mean, a lot of, I mean, don't get of course me wrong. The music I can't fault is great. It on a technical level.
Yeah, I mean, the music's great. I think they're the sort of band that you can do this with, where if you take somebody else, I just don't think it would work. Because it is, it's a spectacle on this very strange scale. Like, they don't need all this crap that they do in concerts now. It's simple and it's effective.
Yes, I mean, that is definitely the case. I like the sort of the way the stage is kind of built around David Byrne over the first few songs is very clever. And the way he comes on and just plays a tape with Psycho Killer is particularly striking. But yeah, I mean, I don't watch masses of concert films, though, you know, I've seen a fair few. And I often end up feeling this way. It's like, well, that's a terrific gig, but if I'm not there, do I gain much from watching it rather than listening to it?
Well, I think this kind of does make that worth watching. This is one of the ones that you can watch as well as listen to. And... You know, the fact that you don't have behind the scenes or interviews or anything like that, I'm happy it's not there in this main feature because I can get absorbed in that experience. Whereas when they sort of cut in between a song to something backstage, I'm like, why? I wanted to listen to the song. Can't we have all this backstage stuff somewhere else? And I don't like how that's
even
done.
Even at the beginning and the end, perhaps, but...
Yeah, you know, and I think they've done it.
The idea of
having
something extra to kind of justify it being, you know, a film rather than an album. It's not a problem with the film itself. I mean, it's well realized. I just don't think it's quite, you know, this huge thing that it's been sort of spoken as sometimes. But that's not to say that I didn't enjoy it a great deal.
I think you B know? Probably has a few things to say about this.
Well, I think, I only knew, like, a few songs from Talking Heads. Like, you know, the classic ones, like Psycho Killer, Once in a Lifetime. But watching when I watched this film the first time, what I loved about it was that it was that even though I'm not there in seeing the band live... what I loved it about the film was that it made me feel like I was there. Right. Like, even just like sitting back, listening to the songs, how it's all the numbers are all staged by, like you said at the beginning, it just starts off with David Byrne just coming out on stage with a cassette player, playing like just the drum bit of Psycho Killer, him just playing along, and then song by song, each of the other band members come out. And also other little sort of, you know, things what he does for each song, including the classic him in Once in a Lifetime. He puts on the really big suit that's like 10 times the size that he is. Sort of like that classic image, and they actually use that for the cover of the DVD and the poster and all that.
Yeah.
I think it does a really brilliant job of actually making you feel like you are there. And I think that to me is the... is when a concert film is effective, as if it makes you feel like you're in the crowd watching this band and soaking in as the crowd's experiencing it. I was going to say that the film isn't just directed by anyone. It's directed by Jonathan Demme, you know, who made a lot of films like Married to the Mob, The Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia and many others. And he brings sort of that cinematic style to this film, which could have easily just been shot standard concert film, but he brings sort of these sort of cinematic techniques to it that makes it feel just more than just, you know, putting place in the camera there and just watching the band. Certain angles, certain shots. And I also had to laugh at one moment because he was even managed to bring in his trademark, like the character staring directly at the camera shot, like he does in every single one of his films, which I had a bit of a laugh at when I saw that. But I think that's what I think makes it a classic, well, of the concert film genre, is that I'm not sure what other ones were before that or what's come out since then, but it really makes you feel like that you are there. And I think that's why it's been sort of hailed as one of the great concert films of all time, is that even if you are a fan of the band or not, it makes you feel like you're there. And it made me want to definitely check out more stuff from Talking Heads after watching the film.
I would say that if you're not a fan of the band, this will be fucking unbearable. Obviously. But, The last thing I'll say is I think that some of my feelings about it are probably tied up with the fact that I watched it in my bedroom by myself, which isn't the way you want to experience live music, really. So what I'd really like to do, actually, with this movie, and I think would be the proper way to judge it, is to go and see it at somewhere like the Prince Charles, which may well have it at some point, and go and see it with 200 people and be in a crowd and have that sort of collective experience, because that's what a gig is. It's a collective experience, and it's about that sort of unity of a crowd. And even if it's not the, you know, 3 to 90,000 people that you might find yourself in usually, I think having a crowd will make it feel more dynamic, will make it feel more like a live experience and more like something that you're really being drawn into. So I think that way it would be very much more effective. But whatever I feel about the film, I'm going to buy some Talking Heads albums. So victory, I would say.
Yeah, I agree with you. It would be the sort of thing it would be like a really full experience to see it in the theatre with a packed crowd. And, well, hopefully maybe someone will show it in one of our areas, because that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my rating was, I think, what did I give it? 4.5, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, my rating was 4.5 as well.
I would probably go with a 3 for the experience of watching it at home. I imagine it would go up to a 4 at the cinema.
You're going to get an angry letter from AJ. Once he hears the show, he'll demand you give it a 5 to...
I liked it, and I'm going to buy Talking Heads albums. Why should anyone be cross?
He wants you to give it a 5-star rating, man.
Well, just for AJ... No.
Almost had you. Marcy, I guess what is your final
back
film?
To me. All right, the last one was something that Sam recommended, which is Lady Vengeance from Chanwook Park, Chanwook, however you want to say his name.
I say Chanwook Park.
Chanwook Park. There we go.
I would go with Park Chanwook because that's the correct syntax in Korean. So
Park Chan-wook will be correct in that way, I guess. So this is his third in the Vengeance trilogy, which, as the title suggests, revolves around the main character of a woman who gets imprisoned for, I think, 13 years for murdering a young boy. And once she's released, she goes out to seek the vengeance against the real culprit of that crime. So the film, it starts off very strange. She's getting out of prison, and we see that, and then it slowly kind of reveals who she is, what happened, how she came there, what it was like to be there, who's the real culprit, what she's going to do, what the motivations are with these different things. So it's kind of, I mean, it's the most striking thing about the film, visual, I mean, it's such a visual film. And it looks absolutely amazing. Like, I would want to watch this on Blu-ray to get, you know, an even, you know, better experience. But the central performance from the actress whose name I can't pronounce.
I'm not sure about this, but I think you don't pronounce the L, so it's E-Yong-A.
E-Yong-A. I mean, she's phenomenal. And the way she embodies this character is, I mean, it's stunning. There's nothing, I mean, my words can't do it justice, really. And of course, the film has, I always refer to him as Old Boy, because that's the movie I know him from. Like, that's what Choi I first Min-Chi. Saw him in. So Choi Min-Sik, I mean, he was in, more recently, I Saw the Devil. This guy is just, he's something else, man. Like, there's nothing he can do everything. I'm just convinced. There is not a role that this man cannot do. And he's really, he's frightening with what he does. He doesn't have to do anything. Like, the most simplest things, and he's just, it's disturbing. And it's a deeply personal and it's very harsh film. There's nothing like it that I've really seen. This sort of a thing all of its own. It's difficult to kind of explain and sum up because it's hard for me to kind of say exactly what I want with it, and I don't feel like I'll be doing the film justice by what I say either. But it's...
Well, I mean, was there a particular sequence or a particular thing that made, like, a strong impression on you? Or...
Well, the strongest thing, and this is kind of, you know, spoils the movie, but it has to do with what happens towards the end. I mean, when that stuff starts to happen, it's very powerful. Some things are a bit strange. Some of the prison things I didn't work too well for me. They were kind of a bit weird. But it's, you know, once she's out and the way you sort of wonder how she's coming to work in this particular place, but then you kind of see how that happens and how she functions on the outside compared to on the inside, it's kind of different, but she seems like a very soft person. But then when these things happen, you know, there is nothing that's going to stop her from doing what she set out to do, and that's a very powerful thing.
I think for me, Lady Vengeance was a really interesting case because I went and saw it at the cinema, you know, very excited because I'd very much admired Joint Security Area, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, and Old Boy. And, you know, couldn't wait to see Park's new film. And I was really let down by it, actually. I thought, I just didn't get it. And obviously it's nothing like Old Boy, which I think was kind of a mistake that I made, was to expect Old Boy 2, you know? And... So I came back from it a little disappointed, but also there was something niggling at me about it, telling me that it was better than I'd given it credit for. So I went back the next week and I saw it again. And then I went back the next week and I saw it again. I think I saw it twice more at the Prince Charles. And every time it got better, and now it's easily my favourite of Park's films, one of my favourite films. And I see more in it every time. The intricacy of it on both a narrative and a visual level just blows me away every time I look at it. And there's, I mean, one of the things that stuck out to me this time, because I rewatched it for this because I hadn't seen it in a while.
Mm.
One of the things that stuck out to me is that terrific image when she goes to Australia to meet her estranged daughter.
Mm.
And there's a terrific image that tells a whole 10-minute scene in one shot, which is just an image of this little girl with a knife to her own neck.
Mm.
And that just struck me so much, the idea that Park can tell an entire story that would have taken other filmmakers 10 minutes, 15 minutes to really tell, and he does it in one image. And that's something that I think recurs throughout this film. There's a lot of sort of abrupt cuts and quick scenes and quick images that tell incredible amounts of story and give incredible amounts of feeling out. I think it's especially felt in the schoolhouse scene, which we were talking about a little elliptically as well, when the parents are seeing the videos of their children. That's as much as I'll say. I think that's done brilliantly there.
Definitely.
I actually wrote an essay about that scene. But I understand why the prison stuff takes a while to really warm up to. It did me. I found that stuff more challenging when I first saw it than the slightly more conventional second half of the film. Mm. But it is elliptical and it is intricate. And I love the balance of tones in the first hour in particular, the way it sort of very carefully juggles comedy and drama. Almost absurdism as well. And I just think it's beautifully achieved, and each time you see it, I think the pieces fall more and more into place.
Yeah, it's something that I can see needs to be seen again, and I know that I'll get even more out of it than I already did, and I've been thinking a lot about it since I did see it. And it's something that it's very powerful. It will stick with you, and there's certain things that I haven't been able to stop thinking about. But it's a phenomenal film, and I'm almost sorry I didn't see it sooner.
I think you were right as well to flag up the performances of Lee Young-ae and Choi Min-sik. Particularly Lee Young-ae, because there's such force to her performance, but such sort of serenity as well in certain points. I mean, the way that people are forever telling her you've changed or you're very different now, you really see that break that she has. And I was really disappointed this time because I saw the fade to white version, which is Park's preferred version, which in the second half of the film sort of slowly fades into black and white. And there's one shot towards the end of the film. I mean, there's a lot of shots that use colour brilliantly in the second half. And it is a shame to lose some of that. But there's a particular shot where she rubs off her red eyeshadow. And it's so symbolic and it's so important,
an amazing
the colour
scene.
In that sequence.
Yeah. I can't imagine that being in black and white. Like, it doesn't work.
But, I mean, and in that moment, her performance changes again, just on that dime, as she rubs that eyeshadow off. And it's a testament to how good she is, I think.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think my initial score for this is, like, 4.5 out of 5. I mean, this...
Well, you did better than me first time, then.
I guess because it's been, you know... 6 years since it came out, and even longer with Old Boy. And I wasn't even thinking, you know, of thinking this is anything like that, aside from having, the whole vengeance thing, obviously. But I wasn't thinking I was going to be Old Boy with a chick or anything. I sort of really went into it with an open mind. And I think that's why it really worked for me, and I really want to sit and watch it again. I mean, I think I'll try and get this on Blu-ray when it's available.
Well, I'm glad you liked it so much. I'm made out of it.
And the reason you recommended this one in particular for me?
First of all, I was just kind of surprised that you hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
But also, because for me it was such a grower, I was kind of interested in seeing if it worked for you first time, or you know, your reactions to it as somebody who I know is fond of Park Chan-wook's films. Because this is quite different from his sort of prevailing tone and way of making films. So I think it's quite a break for him. And, yeah, I was interested in seeing how you'd react to it in those ways, really.
Mm. Yeah, well, I'm glad you did. I finally got the chance to see it. Anyone else have anything to say on Lady Vengeance?
I don't really have anything to add other than I think it's interesting and will likely get better when I watch it next. I like Park Chan-wook very much. Old Boy is my favourite of his works. But, yeah, this one is interesting, exciting. I think I had, if not similar feelings to Sam on my first watch, because I didn't outright like not like it or find anything difficult in it. I just found it okay. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
I usually want to hear my opinion. That's all I'm going
to
say.
So you need to see it again as well, then.
Yeah, I actually have my review up. Like, I wrote a mini review for Joe Blow, like, a long, long, long time, about 4 years ago.
Oh, did we argue about it then?
Actually, we did. I wrote it up, and like, a few posts later, you said, basically, you say I should have to see this again because it's a grower.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Yeah, but you don't want to actually read what I actually wrote. It might make you guys angry, so, yeah.
And it's back to you anyway.
Yeah, but
that's just back to you.
Oh, yes.
For the final
back
one.
Back to me. My final film, and I think a lot of people would be looking forward to this one. My final film is a film that Sam recommended me, and it's a film from director Sion Sono. And it came out in 2008, and that is the Japanese film Love Exposure. The first word that pops into my brain while watching this, every time I'm going to think about this movie now, is panties.
The Japanese for you, yes.
And Marcy, if you ever see this film, you'll know exactly why. Believe me, there's a lot of them in this movie. A lot. But it is a very crazy movie. It's not the most insane movie I've ever seen. The two title holders of that are another Japanese movie called House and an 80s horror movie called Hard Rock Zombies. But this movie is still pretty crazy. It is pretty insane. And the fact that it goes for nearly 4 hours... And I discovered this while watching the movie today, before I came on the podcast, that this movie is even longer than Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia goes for about 216 minutes. This one goes for 248 minutes. It is quite a long movie. I've decided to try to explain the plot would be insane to me because so much happens in this movie because like
it's a shame we're not filming it. I'd say you should explain it through the medium of dance. It would make no difference.
Yeah, exactly. Like no, I guess the only way I can explain, there is a plot summary on IMDb. So I might read it off there. Cause if I try to just do it off a whim, it'll just sound completely nuts.
It might sound worse than your Dark Crystal plot summary.
Exactly. But the Dark Crystal plots would be much more easier to say than this movie's plot. But the movie is about, this is from IMDb, three emotionally abused individuals from the fringes of society get locked up in a convoluted love triangle. You, a Catholic boy searching for true love, ends up taking panty shot photos of women in public until he meets Yoko, who he sees as his Virgin Mary. Yoko, an anti-family misandrous girl, finds that her foster mother will be marrying Yu's father. Kyokai, an original sinner and the original leader of the brainwash of a brainwashing cult, co-ordains a plan to convert Yu's family to her cult. Under her careful direction, their lives come crashing together in one fateful street fight.
And that's the first hour.
Exactly. That is the first hour of a nearly four-hour movie. So much happens in this movie. There's so many subplots and subplots within subplots and subplots within subplots within those subplots. So many different characters. The movie is kind of goes back and forth what kind of tone and genre it is. At times it's like a romantic comedy, other times it's like a thriller, other times it's like a drama, other times it's like an existential look at faith, at other times it's martial arts, at other times it's gross out. It's a little bit of everything that's been put into a blender, and what you're served up with is love exposure. And I just realized that rhymed. but it is a very wacky movie, and only the Japanese could get away with a movie like this. But I have to say, I actually, despite all the craziness of this movie, I actually really enjoyed it, surprisingly. I wasn't sure what I was going to make of it. All I knew that the fact is that Sam gave me an almost four-hour movie. Not that I have anything against four-hour movies, but I'm thinking, four-hour crazy Japanese movie, and I'm thinking, oh, geez, what have I got myself into? But I really enjoyed it. It's a really fun movie. I don't want to say it's perfect. It definitely is flawed in a lot of areas. But from beginning to end, you just get caught up by all the madness of what this film does, and you get to a point where you think, you know what, I'm just going to surrender this movie, and I'm just going to have fun with it. And you do. It is a lot of fun. Sometimes the tonal shifts can be a bit jarring, but I think that's all purposeful from what the film's trying to do. And there is sort of that little bit of everything. And what's funny is I just had to laugh. It's not a very conventional movie. I think Sam might have brought this up because I remember he did talk about this film on our second Why Haven't You Seen This Movie podcast. The film's title card. Now, usually a title card usually comes up within the first 5, maybe 10 minutes of a movie.
I think previously probably, the longest I've seen was Eternal Sunshine, where it appears at 14 minutes.
I've actually seen much longer. I think the Friday the 13th remake didn't pop up until 18 minutes into that movie. But this has to hold the title for the title record hold for the longest time it gets to the title card. And you want to know how long it takes for the movie to get to that title card, Marcy?
How long?
An hour in. It, goes through all this, described in the film's plot from IMDb, that's only the first hour. And once that fight scene happens, all of a sudden it's like, bam, love exposure. It's a very wacky movie, and there's so much I could say about it. It's definitely a very unique experience. I don't know if this movie needed to be 4 hours long to tell its story, but I definitely can say it's a very unique film, and I actually had a lot of fun with it. Is it an amazing movie? No, but did I enjoy it for what it? For the nearly 4 hour writing time that I spent with it, yes.
I'm glad you liked it because I've got to say I was worried I was going to break you.
To be honest, I expected it to be like an hour of plot and then 3 hours after that of just craziness, with no narrative whatsoever. But there actually is a plot to this movie. And it's funny, though, because I could say, they could have easily just cut stuff out. But it's funny that all the subplots, every single subplot in this movie is actually, funny enough, kind of essential to the movie. mm-hmm. in some way. Like, one, you think, oh, this subplot could be easily taken out, but for some reason, oh, that has to be there to serve this purpose later on in the movie. And
I mean, yeah, I've seen 90-minute movies that have half an hour of easy cuts that aren't, you know, related to the plot, that have no reason to be there. I couldn't say that I can see cuts in this film, really. You know, there's a lot of moments that if you took them out, they look like they might be easy to remove, but they actually turn out to be keystones.
Yeah, yeah. Like, they are keystones to the film's major plot, and I think all the cast did a really good job. Everyone sort of really commits to their performance. There's not even a single bad performance in the film. Like, everyone does their parts perfectly, from the biggest to the smallest roles. And, yeah, and it also has a really nice ending as well. And it's just fun. Like, it's a really enjoyable movie. Like, I was worried that this movie might break me. But it's definitely a one-of-a-kind, original, enjoyable, sort of fun movie. Like, I do have problems with its sort of tonal shiftness at times and unevenness, but overall, in the end, I did enjoy it. Is it a movie I need to watch again? Maybe not for quite a while, but I did enjoy it and I did like it. So.
I mean, I would go further than you. I think it's pretty dazzling, actually. And I've seen a few of Sion Sanoh's films now, and I don't know that there's a filmmaker out there like him. He makes these weird, balmy, wonderful concoctions. I mean, they're all pretty long as well. His latest one, Cold Fish, which I know Marcy's seeing soon, is a 2.5-hour serial killer movie, which is really strange, and though more conventional than Love Exposure, and really just brilliant as well. And I'm just excited now by the idea that, you know, there's a directorial credit that says Sion Sanoh. It's going to be exciting, you know. It's going to be different. I'm not going to have seen this movie before. In reference to Love Exposure, I think, as much as I do think it's great fun, and I do think it's very funny, I also think it's quite a serious film as well. I mean, I think it's quite an emotional film. I think it does the father-son relationship rather nicely, it kind of strangely. I think it's also got some interesting things to say about religion, cults. I think it's got real ideas there backing up the wackiness. Because if it was just wackiness, it could be pretty insufferable. But I think there's genuine thought behind it and genuine ideas in it. On a performance level, I agree with you. I think everyone's great. But I would single out Sakura Ando, who plays Koika, the cult leader, the regional cult leader. And that's just such a wonderfully manipulative, menacing performance, particularly the way that she inveigles herself into Yoko's affections when she knows that Yu is desperately in love with Yoko. So the way to sort of affect him is to become her lover, basically. And that whole plot thread works beautifully and is really well done. And I love the sort of the steel behind Koika, and also the lunacy of her. It's a brilliant piece of acting. I really like that performance a lot. But yeah, it's just so unlike anything else I've ever seen. And at this stage, you know, I've said it before, but 8,000 movies in, that alone is something to be celebrated, something to be loved. And while I think there's so much more to why I love this film than that, certainly doesn't hurt, you know.
I agree. I do agree with a lot of things you say. It's definitely, like I said, I really enjoyed the time with it. Like I do have problems with it, but overall, I did enjoy it for what it was. And like you say, it's definitely a very unique, unique film that I haven't seen before. So, you know, it gets major kudos for me just for being something that, that I haven't seen in quite a long time. That's this kind of bold and bombastic. And, I definitely have to give it kudos just for that.
Mike, I know you've seen it as well.
Yeah, and I agree with you really in the fact that I love its wackiness. I love the way it moves around in quite a dynamic way in regards to genre. 1 minute it's a gender swap comedy, then a teen drama, then a satire on religion, then a kung fu movie, and it's just everything, and it's so well balanced as well. And in fact, a lot of the film is driven by music, most of it classical, many tracks repeated over and over again, but also some really good Japanese pop tunes, and that really helps drive the movie and make sure it doesn't feel 4 hours long. And yeah, I just love how bold it is and how original it is. But despite all of that, the wackiness, the kookiness, the craziness, I do think it is a film of depth, of emotion, of ideas. It does have something really profound to say about religion and about the father-son relationship in particular. I think the final hour of the film, which begins with a kidnapping and ends with a breakout, is just driven completely by the emotions that you've been allowed to build up for the past 3 hours. And I actually find it really quite moving, and it gives me food for thought. And it's a film that I've seen twice now and will definitely see a third as soon as possible. I just love it.
Cool. I guess there's so much, like I said, we can, all three of us can really say about the movie. And Marcy, you had seen it as well, because yeah, this would make a very interesting discussion of the zaniness that is Love Exposure.
Yeah, I didn't have really the time with the other stuff I had to watch, and but I'm sure I will get to it. As Sam brought up, I will be seeing his other movie, Cold Fish, very soon, so that might just be enough to drive me to go see this.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to what you make of that, because that's bizarre as well.
Looking forward to it.
Bloody as all hell as well. It's
you're gonna get something out of it as a gore hound here.
Yeah.
Although I'm really interested to see what our friend of the show, AJ, thinks of Love Exposure, because I know he's not.
See, he refuses to see it because he didn't like Noriko's Dinner Table. Well, I say didn't like, actively rebelled against is probably the best phrase. I love Noriko's Dinner Table, for the record. I think it's a terrific film, even if it is more challenging, I think, than Love Exposure, which is saying something.
Yeah, but AJ also didn't like The Suicide Club as well. So I think there's...
it's nothing like that either.
Well, I suppose, like, I'd definitely say it's worth checking out, even if, like, everyone out there, like, the film is definitely worth checking out, but I definitely would say you have to make a day for it and try to make sure you're not doing other things on that day, like I had, because I had to watch this entirely from midday today until, like, the time we did this podcast. Like, on and off during the day, so never again. Definitely check out Love Exposure. It's a really interesting, really unique, and really enjoyable original film that deserves to be seen.
Cool.
But if I had to rate it, I'd probably give it about a 4 out of 5. Like, it's definitely an experience of a film, so it's definitely my highest rating. Like I said, I do have problems with it, but, you know, I still really like the film, so, and I'll stop saying anything now.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's unquestionably a 5 out of 5. I mean, just knocked me away and knocked my socks off. I just thought it was tremendous. So, yeah, I mean, I don't give them out much, but this gets one.
I think it would be a 4.5 for me, because there are a couple of problems with it, but in the grand scheme of things, you know, they're just little niggles. You can't really pick apart a film this original and this bold and exciting.
Yep.
Mm.
I guess that
is that
that's the end of
everybody.
That's it.
I guess
yep.
that's the end of the
yep.
show.
Yeah. Not well, quite as long as Love Exposure, but a nice lengthy podcast.
Well, I guess we only now have to thank people for listening and thank Bede.
Yes.
And Marcy.
Yes.
And Mike for
and
participating.
Sam.
I was really expecting you guys to chime in there when I said your names.
Well, I said and Sam.
Yeah.
And you're welcome. And
but,
listen
yeah,
out for
so
a future episode.
The first Movie Exchange Club podcast, and I'm looking forward to doing it again. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I already have that's movies planned.
I'm willing for it, as long as I don't get another, like, 2 4-hour movies for it again.
I will not give you a 4-hour movie. I've already said I'm going to give you Showa.
That's right.
No, I'm not going to give Bede a 9.5-hour movie, by the way, everybody. So,
yes,
that would be cruel.
I'd commit suicide right there if you did. So, yeah. So, I guess that's the end of tonight's show. And I hope everyone enjoyed it.
And
we'll definitely
it.
Be doing more of these type of podcasts in the future, I hope.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. Well, thanks again for listening.
Yes, catch you later.
See you, everyone.
Bye. Bye.